Welcome to Steppin' Out of Babylon, produced by Sue Supriano. Babylon is everywhere. It's the isms and schisms not only within the system, but within ourselves. Let's unify, stand aligned, and step out of Babylon.
My name's Sue Supriano, and my guest today is Lynn Gary. Actually, we're in San Francisco at the Independent Media Center during the National Association of Broadcasters annual meeting. The National Association of Broadcasters are the corporate media, we call them, because that's what they are. And we are the independent media. And Lynn Gary, you've come from New York, although you lived in Los Angeles for a long time and worked with the Pacifica station in Los Angeles, and you've started, I don't know how many years ago, the radio project on the internet. And well, maybe you can just tell the audience what you're doing, because you've certainly been an outspoken and very much an activist, getting balls rolling in many different arenas in creating and keeping some independent media.
Okay. Yeah, the radio project was something that we started in 1996. Now the idea of having sound on the internet is not very unusual. But at that time, many computers didn't even have the capability to hear sound. It was something very new at that time. And this was before the independent media centers were created. In a way, it grew out of the micropower radio movement, and since I come from community radio, I don't differentiate between the size of the transmitter. It's really the purpose to which the broadcast goes.
I just want to interrupt you and just say that, it's very possible a lot of our audience doesn't even know what the micropower movement is, because we have a very broad audience, I think.
Okay. Let me explain that. The micropower radio movement, particularly in the United States here, is something that has been growing for about the past 10 years. It's also called low-power FM or pirate radio. That because of the consolidation of media, the gobbling up of what are supposed to be the public airwaves by the group which is represented here in San Francisco this week, the National Association of Broadcasters, people are left with very little opportunity to exercise their rights of discourse on the airwaves that are supposedly public. Within community, non-commercial, public, however you want to call that radio, over the same years, there has been a parallel trend where what was once an accessible medium where people from a community could come in, learn how to use the skills, have discussions about things they cared about, whether it was political issues, particular music they like, something unusual that's not often discussed because it's considered to have too narrow of an interest to a market, to a mass market, to sell advertising, etc. This was the purpose of community radio. Over the past number of years, the same pressures of consolidation, professionalization, and commercialization have happened there as well. So this is now epitomized by national public radio, which is national. It's radio, but it has no public in it whatsoever. It's heavily subsidized by corporations. The content is very much geared either towards what's happening inside the Beltway or towards the corporate view of reality. The discourse is framed within the parameters that are considered acceptable to corporate America. A debate upon an issue never includes something like, Well, gee, let's just get rid of these corporations altogether. This is not something that ever enters into a debate. You know, let's have a society that's not based on market principles. Let's have a society that's not based on competition, but that's based on cooperation. These are things that don't even enter into the debate, you know, and of course, even a third-party presidential candidate like Ralph Nader, an enormously credible, well-known person, boy, they sure can't have reports on him, even though every time George Bush or Al Gore breaks wind, it's reported on NPR. And of course, that's because this is underwritten by Archer, Daniel Midland's, all of this stuff. Okay, so what is a micropower radio in this context? Because of the same technological advances that have brought us the internet and, you know, very, very small radios and all kinds of other gadgetry, people have been able to make small radio transmitters that are accurate and easy to use. And this, at one time, was just not possible, where a person with a modicum of skill could set up their own radio station. And people began to do this in violation of the law because the law would not grant a license for a low-power FM station, low-power being below 100 watts. To give you some idea, your average commercial radio station that you hear might be 10,000 watts or 50,000 watts, somewhere in that neighborhood. So we're talking about a radio transmitter that will cover a neighborhood or a small town. People began setting these up in defiance of the law and having community radio stations. They'd bring in people from the community, have different types of programs, whatever people wanted to talk about. And these things were aggressively pursued by the government with the instigation of the National Association of Broadcasters, who was terribly threatened by this.
Okay. You know, I want to say, too, that some of our audience is international,
yeah.
And actually there are micro-broadcasting stations, small stations, that are sometimes illegal, depending on which country that you're in. And I just am realizing that the National Association of Broadcasters is also seems to be international. It, much to my surprise, I don't really understand it, but I know people have been telling me they've been talking to people from other countries who have radios here in San Francisco during this meeting, that people are here from all over the world. And also, because you work on the internet, which is, of course, extremely international, I just want to remind tell you about this, and you might have some, I don't know, some overview or some insight or some things to add.
Okay, well, now in a lot of countries, radio stations have been owned only by the government. Here in the United States, very, very early on in the 1920s, when radio first began to be viable and widespread, there was a move on the public airwaves by commercial interests who drove out the non-commercial interests and said, well, you know, this is how we're going. Commercial interests were viewed as being able to provide radio that was true public service and not special interest groups. Of course, the fact that there are people whose purpose is to market products, to the populace is not considered a special interest for some reason, but this is America. Okay, so you have to understand that there are people for whom the only meaningful activity in life, and they view the sole purpose of America as people making money and plundering around the world. And if you're around the world, you probably had a piece of the American empire shoved up your derriere at least once. Okay, so we're talking about issues within the heart of the empire itself, where most of the media is actually owned by corporations, although it's technically licensed by the government. Once they own these licenses, they sell them to one another for millions of dollars. And they've passed laws through Congress to allow them to own as many as they want. So now there are media conglomerates that will own 300 or 400 stations. Okay, so the micropower movement was born to create some other sort of alternative. Since the law was not going to cooperate with the people in using their own airwaves, they did it outside of the law. And the National Association of Broadcasters was very upset, even with these tiny stations, because these might be people, they would take people away from being victimized by their advertising, which is the real reason that they are in business, is to sell advertising, not to communicate about issues of importance. So that was the micropower movement. Now, we're talking about people with no money whatsoever that scraped together a few $100s, maybe a few $1,000s to set up a radio station. And we said, how can we help these radio stations really be meaningful in terms of delivering news to a community? And a local community needs to know about things that are happening locally. They need to know about national affairs, and they need to know about international affairs, because there is no truly local issue anymore. Everything that happens to us wherever we live is influenced by things that are being decided far away from where we are, by people we have never seen and may not even know of. So around this time, the internet was coming into play, the World Wide Web. And we said, well, if people all over the world can record things where they are, because it doesn't take a lot of money to, you know, go someplace in your town with your tape recorder and get a story, then you can take it, put it up on the internet, and a station somewhere else can take that down, turn it back into a, you know, put it back onto a tape, and put it on the air. And that way, stations will be able to do meaningful news gathering that will, you know, connect us, basically connect the grassroots of the, you know, regions, nations, and around the globe together with a source of information that was previously only available to corporate media with their Associated Press and Reuters and et cetera, wire services.
So that's when you started Radio for All, the radio project. And if you would, Lynn Gary, describe what it is.
Okay, what it is a website. And it's located at www.radioforall.net, radio, the number 4, ALL.net. And there are a list of radio programs that people have put up, and anyone is free to contribute their programs. Other people come along, and you can download that program onto your computer's hard drive, and if you listen to it there, if that's what you choose, or put it back onto tape and put it on your radio station if you've got a community radio station. And I know I also produce a radio program at a community radio station, and it's been tremendously helpful to me, because I can say, oh, you know, I'm doing something on this issue. Let me search and see what there is. And I find, oh, yes, here's somebody someplace who's interviewed this person. Well, I don't have to worry about, gee, how do I get hold of this person to interview them? How do I travel there, et cetera, and so forth? Because someone has already done it. And if it's a good interview, then that's what I play, because the main important thing for me is I want to get information about the issue to my community. And so that's how we use it. And it's really worked out very well. And it was geared when a group of people met on an email list. We were from all over the world, and we talked and set this up. Most of us had never met in person and still have never met in person. It was all done, you know, somewhat remotely, because that's how the internet is. And we were able to put up this thing that's been used by thousands and thousands of people, most of whom have never met in person, but have been able to support each other's work, you know, through this thing, which we say is it takes advantage of the breadth of reach of the internet and the democracy and accessibility of radio, because I know that throughout the world, most places still don't have the ability to get on the internet easily, but people do have the ability to receive FM radio. So if you can get even someone in a village who's able to get something off the internet, then, you know, they're able to put it onto the radio and everyone else can hear it. So that was the idea behind it.
Yeah. I want to tell the audience that Lynn Gary, you also do this work with your partner, Sean Awald, who you met over the internet, and now you're living together. So yeah, you're both partners in doing Radio for All and living together, partners in that way. So the internet is really useful personally and politically and socially in every kind of way. Do you find that people do use Radio for All a lot? And how many programs do you have up there?
Well, we've now got almost 1,200 programs up there. And this is since we're kind of open to the public in early 1997. You know, we planned and worked out the technology of this for about 6 months. So in about 3 years, 3.5 years, we've got 1,200 programs. And in the past 6 months, the number of people putting things up and taking things down has quadrupled. So I think what's happened is we're beginning to reach a point where there are many, many more people that are getting their hands on the technology and getting the you know, knowledge of how to turn a piece of sound into a computer file and overcoming that discomfort with that idea. So the participation has really, really increased, and it's very encouraging. Most of the stuff we get is from North America, but we're starting to see things coming from Mexico, from Germany, from Australia, from Spain, and things like that. So that's very exciting. We had always meant it to be a multilingual, worldwide thing, but to tell you the truth, we haven't yet fully developed how to mirror all the functions of the complex piece of software in a number of languages. And that's something that we're still working on. The project is in constant development. We're always trying to improve it because the software that it runs on was written specifically for it. And in fact, we had one version. Our first version was written by a guy called Tom Lane. And the second version was written by my partner, Sean Ewald. And he's working on, constant updates of that. And, yeah, by the way, we met on this project. He was one of the people on that email list. And I say almost all of us have never met. He was a person, he lived only 300 miles away from me, as opposed to some people that were 6,000 or 11,000. And I said, hey, let's meet. And it turned out we did end up living together. So when people say, oh, the internet, those are virtual relationships and virtual interactions. And I say, well, that's total nonsense. There's nothing virtual about it.
Well, that's great. So is this all free? Do you make money from this? Does anybody make money or lose money?
Nobody makes money. A few people, you can say a few people lose money because there's a few people that have donated. A guy in San Jose, California, David Josephson, has donated bandwidth for this project for many, many years, and he's paid personally out of his pocket. And Sean and I have put, money into it. I mean, the whole thing hasn't cost a lot, but it's getting to the point now where we have to keep getting more space because there's so much stuff, and because there's so much traffic, we're going to have to look at getting more bandwidth for the server, and then there's some money issues. So we may, for the first time, really start to do some serious fundraising. At the beginning, we said, well, I don't know if we're going to be able to raise money for people because this thing is so new that people are going to not maybe feel that the thing is meaningful enough or important enough that they need to support it. The idea always was to have it be a users, producers, cooperative, that the people who would use it would be the ones that would support it. You know, we didn't want to rely on grants or other things like that. And so now that we've got a lot of users, and hopefully that we can say to these people, okay, folks, you've been using this thing now pretty regularly. Is it important to you? Then, you know, can you please help? Because, you know, we've become successful now, and our success is outstripping our resources. We need to expand, because it's a funny thing about success on the internet. Success on the internet is when a lot of people come and, you visit your site, you use your material, download your material. But if too many people come, the server gets completely jammed up and nobody can get in. So you have a traffic jam that renders you unusable because of your success. So then you have to keep expanding, the amount of bandwidth you have so that people will be able to, not get in too much of a logjam when they're coming, because sound files are big and they take a long time to download. So it's not like a quick little text file on a website. Somebody may be on there, you know, so to speak, hooked up to the teat there for an hour and a half, taking it down bit by bit. So anyway, so those are some of the issues that, but no, nobody makes any money out of it. Nobody ever intended to make any money out of it. The purpose of the, you know, the purpose of the radio project is social change. It's creating a world that's based on values that are not based on money and profit, that are based on, you know, human values, you know, planetary values, you know, values of peace and cooperation, not values of competition and market principle.
And obviously you and Sean put a huge numbers of hours. If you were to get paid, you'd be rich, but paid in money. Yeah. But now you're rich in satisfaction, I'm sure.
Well, actually, yeah, I really am satisfied. There were some times when I didn't think the thing was going to fly. I said, oh, why are we doing this? You know, is this really useful to anybody? Because it was meant to be useful to people. And you say, well, if you go through all this work and it's not useful to people, what's the point of doing it? You know, spare the effort, do something that's maybe more useful. And it's turned out to be useful. And so, yes, we are very gratified. Mm-hmm. And we've met people, you know, I've been, you know, using the radio project for years. And, oh, I thank you so much for that really feels good.
Yeah, I'm sure. Well, here we are at an independent media center in San Francisco, as I said at the beginning of the program. And we started independent media centers. I say we because I was part of it in Seattle last November at the World Trade Organization, Anti-World Trade Organization activities. And we decided we would come together and do a better job of taking the media into our own, putting out our own media from our own point of view that didn't have the corporations and the money making in between. And now there's at least 30 independent media centers all over the world. And as I've been involved in this one the last few days, I know that we promised we'd have streaming audio, and a lot of the times it's not working, and things aren't going exactly how we'd like them to go. But it's still incredibly exciting because we're getting together, and some things are going fine, and we're meeting each other. And I'm just talking myself here because I find it's such a positive feeling, because so many things in the world, at least for those of us who are educated about them, and because we get information from somewhere other than just the corporate media, that we know about a lot of the very serious things going on in the planet. So it's a very hopeful and positive to me that this is happening. Would you like to comment, Lynn Gary, on the Independent Media Center movement?
Well, yes. I mean, I think it's wonderful. And I, you know, I always hate to even say anything bad about it. I've worked at a few, you know, IMCs myself, and you know, there's often a lot of frustrations. But I hate to say anything bad about it, because the fact that people are doing it is so positive at what is what needs to happen. One of the things that is a reality is the independent media centers were geared towards being set up to cover a specific event, a big event that was happening. And I think the next step for the IMCs is find ways to keep those IMCs open, because usually the thing folds down. It's in a temporary space. It folds down after the, you know, the WTO or the IMF or whatever it is occurrence happens, and there is no ongoing media center. I think the next step, and that's the problem, this is where the, you know, always the money issue is. We always come up against the money issue, is having a space, maintaining a space, being able to bring people in from the community and train them to be their own media. And that's what the whole community radio movement, the micropower movement, the media centers all have in common, is that there is always a point of view from which the media that we receive comes. And that point of view is a corporate point of view. It is a state point of view. And of course, in the United States, the corporations and the state are one and the same. So if we are to have issues and information that serves those of us who are, not part of the corporate elite, not part of the government elite, but are really its, targets and its victims, if we're to have something that's going to empower us and, give us the promise of democracy that is not actually delivered, we must have the information. We must get it ourselves. That's the principle behind the IMC movement. And the way to have it is to broaden those things and sustain them and have them be regular and not just cover a huge event that comes into town, but the things that happen in our areas on a, day-to-day basis. The websites remain, and people can put things up on those websites.
And should have said that, in fact, the way the independent media gets expressed is over websites, again, over the internet, although, again, like things mm-hmm. from Radio for All, it can be taken off and played on the TV channel, mm-hmm. on the radio station, or listened to and watched and read in your house.
Yes, exactly. I know on our radio show we've taken, both articles that we read or sound stories that have been put up and used, and so have other people. So I think the next step is to find ways to have a physical space that remains so that people can come in and do media on an ongoing basis. And that is a big step from where we are now to where we have to go. But that's what I see as kind of the next challenge for the independent media center movement.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that's happening with the independent media center movement also is that it's democratic within the way we operate with each other. We do things by consensus or democratically, and this is all under in very stressful working conditions that are not very comfortable. Usually we're actually sitting on the floor as we're doing this interview, and this is a lot more comfortable than it was in Los Angeles during the Democratic Convention, where the windows didn't open and it was 110 degrees outside and there was no air conditioning. But it's such a good feeling to know that we're doing this good work and creating models of working together at the same time that are different than the hierarchical models that we are so prevalent in this society.
Yeah, I think that is a very important point, because this is something that the corporate media and the corporate structure would say is impossible. The argument that they make is that human beings are shiftless, lazy, and incompetent. Unless they've got a slave master over them to whip them, they will not be able to accomplish anything. And in fact, free people allowed to all develop and use their own initiative and be heard and be valued can accomplish a whole lot more with a whole lot less. And this is not only about media, but it's, I think, a metaphor for a whole lot of other issues in this world. Our governments are in the way of solving the problems of the world. And that's something that I think the Independent Media Center serves as an example for.
Yeah. Well, we got to stop, and that sounds also like a perfectly good place to do it. Let's give these web pages. I'd like to say the web page of the Independent Media Center is indymedia.org, and there you can find all the Independent Media Centers from all over the world.
Right. Well, anyway, thank you, Sue.
And
it's nice to
go to the Radio for All.
Oh, yes, Radio for All, www.radioforall.org. Radio, the number 4, ALL.org.
Thank you so much, Lynn Gary. And my name's Sue Supriano, and thank you for listening.